Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming today. I want to talk a little bit about the books first. I had the great privilege of reading these over the Easter holidays. And I have to say, the one thing that, although the books are different in tone and in style, the one thing that unites these two books, I felt, was the spirit of inquiry that informs them. I have to say, I was utterly, utterly stunned by the diversity of human experience that both of you have documented. And not just the diversity of human experience, but also what really staggered me was the, given that you're both working in very conservative traditional societies, the candor of the response. I found that extremely humbling and very, very moving. And although the books, both books have great, are hopeful books, both of them look forward to a brighter future, I found them also very moving for the sadness which is the lives of so many people in the subcontinent as well as North Africa. What should actually be a source of great joy is in fact a source of tremendous suffering for so many people. But before I become too maudlin, I thought if you will allow me, I will just start with a small anecdote which I think may illustrate our conversation later and then move on to the discussions of your book. Many millennia ago, when I was a student in Pakistan, I attended a school called the Convent of Jesus and Mary, and I was doing my A-levels. I was about 15, my O-levels, I was about 15 at that time, and much to the consternation of the Irish nuns who ran the school, one of the topics which was introduced as a subject in our biology course that year was called human reproduction, not sexual reproduction, human reproduction. So they got this Pathan lady to come and teach us human reproduction, and she zipped through the topic in about, I think, an hour. And then just about 2 minutes before break, she said, "Any questions?" So there was this one intrepid girl, and she raised her and she said, Miss, if you have sex when you are having your period, do you get pregnant?" And she looked at her and she fixed her with this gimlet stare and she said, "Muslims don't behave that way."
And they don't have sex or they don't menstruate? That's the question.
I think they don't menstruate, they don't have sex, they just don't behave that way at all. So, you know, when I was reading your book and I found out all the ways in which Muslims do behave...
We have whole chapters in the history of Arabic erotica just on that subject. How to get it on during menstruation.
You must tell me the names of these books. But anyway, what prompted you to write these books? Sally, shall I...
I think I just sort of noticed that India was at a changing point. I travelled to India over many years, for around sort of 20 years since I was a backpacker. And in the sort of backpacking days, I've been subject to quite a lot of eve teasing, you know, petty groping.
Lovely phrase, eve teasing.
Lovely phrase, it makes it seem so innocuous, yes. Doesn't it? Bit of sort of slap and tickle fun. But my favourite anecdote was a friend who was on a train and she was sort of sitting there going along, going sort of, you know, typical route sort of south to Goa from Mumbai. And she's pulling out for Ratnagiri station, the sun was coming up, it was sort of really beautiful sunlight, and she sort of looked out the window and saw a young man on a bicycle, thought, "Oh, hi," smiled at the young man, did a quick sort of second turn and saw that he was masturbating with one hand whilst cycling with the other. It was a real sort of, these sort of real kind of feats of endurance, actually. So it was this
and keeping pace with the moving train.
It's quite spectacular.
The future in Formula One for that.
Dexterity, amazing. But I think it was this sort of this, that I'd experienced this of India, but I'd also experienced this sort of transporting, you know, the land of the Taj Mahal, this land that gave us sort of love and romance and all of these sort of ideas around sexuality, and of course the Kama Sutra, which I'm sure we'll go into later. So it was to try and reconcile these two things at a time when I propose in the book that a sexual revolution is taking place. So.
When I was growing up in Pakistan, I'm sure it was the same in India, when you went to see a Western film, people came together to kiss like this and moved away back because it censored that bit in the middle.
Yeah.
So it was always like that. But, and Shireen, yourself?
So, as you know, I spent 5 years traveling across the Arab region from Morocco right through to Egypt and then from Saudi Arabia up through to Lebanon, talking to people about sex, and what they do, what they think, what they don't do, and why. And I know, depending on your perspective, this might sound like a dream job or possibly a really dubious occupation. But for me, it came from my personal and professional background. So personally speaking, I am half Egyptian. I am Muslim, and most of my family live in the Arab region, but I grew up in the West in Canada, very far from my Arab roots, and I didn't think much about my Arab heritage until September 11th, actually. And the terrible events of that day really impelled me to want to learn more about where I came from, really. The fact that I chose sex as my lens, I know, is a little unusual, but that comes from my professional background. I trained as an immunologist, and my first job at The Economist magazine was writing about global healthcare, and part of my job was reporting on the global HIV/AIDS epidemic. And I became interested in understanding what is happening around HIV in the Arab world. And if you want to know about HIV in the Arab region, you have to look at sex, because it's the main route of transmission. And as I started talking to people about sex within that sort of public health framework, it became clear to me that sex is this amazing lens through which to understand any society, because what's happening inside the bedroom is affected by forces on a bigger stage in terms of politics, economics, and religion and tradition. And as I argue in the book, this vice versa, what happens in intimate life also has repercussions on the bigger stage as well. And so as I say in my book, if you really want to know a people, you start by looking inside their bedrooms, and that's exactly what I did.
And what you uncovered was actually, what both of you uncovered was actually quite grim, wasn't it? At least I found it pretty horrendous. I had never thought that the levels of female circumcision in Egypt was so high, for instance.
But it's actually declining. I think it's all relative where you're starting from, but what you're referring to is that in Egypt, we have a practice, female genital mutilation. Is everyone familiar with this? Good, I don't have to go into the gritty detail. 80% of Egyptian girls aged 15 to 17 are circumcised, and that is a lot, but that is compared to 95% 10 years ago.
So in the last 10 years, it's dropped by 15%.
Yeah, and it's much lower in certain populations. That's a national average. Yeah.
No, but also the levels of domestic violence, for instance. And I don't mean a slap or a push or an occasional black eye. I mean sort of, you know, chopping people's noses off and burying people alive, women alive. And
sorry, that wasn't in my book, actually. Perhaps
that's Pakistan.
Sorry.
Yeah. That's Pakistan. Chopping the nose off is a sign of that you've shamed us. Your nose is your pride, yeah.
Well, in India, certainly, there's a sort of huge level.
Massive.
I mean, and not even, you know, sexual violence. Sexual violence is a sort of expression of rage against other is very common, so the sort of rise of the sort of Hindu nationalism and the attacks on Muslims often in India often are very, very much have a sexual element. So yeah, it's sexual violence is a tool on a grander scale.
Yeah. But also the criminalization of homosexuality recently in India.
Yes.
I mean, I was surprised that, you know, just as India is about to sort of embrace globalization, they pass this law.
Well, it's sort of two countervailing forces, because the reason sex is illegal in India is because of the Raj and because the sort of laws. During our kind of time in Britain, when the Purity movement was holding sway here, all of these laws were sort of imported or transposed onto India. So actually they're a sort of import from this time, but they're now seen as part of Indian culture. And it's sort of sex, it's a law against unnatural sexual acts that by default make sex, homosexual sex, illegal. It's not actually criminalising gay sex per se. So it's interesting, yeah, this repression is actually a throwing off. When it was obviously sort of gay sex was criminalised and decriminalised in 2008, great, you know, celebration across India, the gay pride that year was wonderful, and now a lot of this sort of conservative backlash against this sort of is seen as being a backlash against the invading forces of homosexuality from the West, and that's untrue. It's untrue. Yeah.
But you both say that it was not always so. in India and in Egypt and in the Middle East, that there was much greater, it was a more permissive society. It was more liberal.
More pragmatic.
More pragmatic.
Pragmatic society. I think, certainly within the context of Islam, the boundaries are there, halal and haram. But quite frankly, it's not all black and white, even at those what seemingly hard borders. There are at least 50 shades of gray when it comes to talking about sex in Islam. And it's true that if one looks back at the long history of writing about sexuality in Arabic, we have this extraordinarily rich history that really spans a millennium, from the time of the Prophet Muhammad really until the 19th century. I'm telling you, there is nothing in The Joy of Sex or Cosmopolitan or indeed 50 Shades of Grey that they were not writing about 1,000 years ago in Baghdad. Really quite amazing. And what's interesting is when the Arabs were at the zenith of their political and economic and cultural power, they had no problems with sex. And what's interesting is as we have been in this sort of very extended period of decline, quite frankly, that we've also become very bottled up around sex, and everything becomes haram, forbidden, everything becomes aib, shameful. And the really interesting question in the wake of the uprisings of 2011 is, as we struggle towards greater freedom and openness in the political and economic and social sphere, what is that going to look like in our bedrooms?
How is it going to reflect in the bedroom?
And vice versa. Mm.
And India as well. You say that there's Kama Sutra, there's the Khajuraho temple.
There's a huge sort of rich and various history. And there's a sense of humor too. So in the sort of ancient sexuality, you have voyeuristic gods, you have this sort of beautiful kind of expression of open copulation. But then it's not all that it seems, because the Kama Sutra was written during the Gupta Empire as a guide for the man about town or the rich man of the era, and how to sort of enjoy the lower orders in terms of sort of sexual fun. So it's not all as it seems. But even in the Kama Sutra, which was written for this market, you have this idea that women should enjoy sex, which is, you know, really revolutionary to many kind of mindsets. Mm. And you have a sort of sense of play within sex. And then you have the sort of history of Tantra, which was permeated most, obviously, as we know, most religions for 700 years, that was about expressing the earthly. And it was about expressing the earthly rather than this idea that came before, that it was all about an illusion. Mm. We had to express the earthly, and part of that is, you know, and if you've been to Khajuraho or any of the sort of erotic temples in India, you just see the sense of fun and you think, actually, it's something that we in the West have lost. Mm.
But it's right about the sense of pleasure, and that's what comes across in this, you know, centuries of writing. Today, the only time that we can talk about sex openly in most Arab societies is to make sex a problem. It's a disease like HIV, or it's an exploitation like trafficking, or it is a crime, or it is a scandal. Mm. But the idea of sex as being a source of well-being and a source of pleasure, that's lost. And see, it's not unique to the Arab region. You see it in India, and you see it across the global south. And this is a real challenge for people working in development, for example, because to recapture that spirit. But in terms of the humor, I'm wondering if I can just read
the passage. Sure, please.
So, again, the idea of pleasure and fun in sex. This is a passage from a book called The Encyclopedia of Pleasure, which was written in 10th, 11th century Baghdad. And it tells the story of a woman living in Medina at the time of the birth of Islam. And she's called Huba al-Madaniya. Huba al-Madaniya, for instance, said that one day she went out of the bath accompanied by a boy who had a puppy. It so happened that the puppy, seeing her vulva and vaginal lips, went between her legs and began to lick her organ. She lowered her body to give the animal a better chance of performing its job. However, when she had reached an orgasm, she fell down heavily upon it and could not raise herself until the helpless animal had died from heavy pressure. apologies to animal lovers in the audience.
Sally, please feel free to read something from your book too, if you'd like.
Yes, I mean, it's more of a photo in terms of the sort of sense of fun. Maybe I'll pass it around, actually. That might be a better thing to do. This is when I'm at Khajuraho, and we're walking around a corner of the temple, And if anyone's who's not been, it's all of these sort of parades of lusty friezes, of copulating gods, court maidens, animals, in flagrante, in this sort of gorgeous sort of spread of copulation. Adjei leads us to the jutting west quadrant corner of the temple, and then with a lightning grin exclaims, "Look, here's something showing what ancient Hindus can teach us about not taking sex and religion too seriously. It's Ganesh, the elephant god, wearing a broad smile. And what's he looking at? It's a trick of perspective. We round 90 degrees of the temple wall and see, behind Ganesh, a bald-headed Brahmin priest in flagrante with a court maiden, supplely doubled over, forehead to her knees. It becomes clear now that Ganesh is looking on, the self-congratulating voyeur. This playfulness would be unconscionable in the Judeo-Christian tradition, or in Islam, especially 21st century Islam, undergoing its painful spasms of change. And what I might do is pass around this picture of the Ganesh.
Can we start here?
Yeah.
Oh, good heavens.
Yeah.
So what brought about the change, do you think? What brought about the change from sex as a source of joy and pleasure and play to this sort of pent-up anger and rage about sex and this kind of frustration and the declaring it haram, etc.?
I think the closing down around sex is part and parcel of a much sort of broader, longer historical process. This is the closing down in almost all domains in across Arab societies. And what's interesting about the history of Arabic erotica is that it pretty well dries up around the 19th century. And it's not a coincidence that that's the time that many countries in the region are colonized by Europeans, and this comes back to the point they're raising, that if not laws that were imposed around sort of criminalizing unnatural practices, et cetera, certainly a spirit enters, particularly amongst the upper classes, which begins to question, have we fallen under the sway of Western powers because somehow we are what they say we are? We are debauched, we have deviated from the true way of Islam, the Sharia. Mm-hmm. And this becomes part of the discourse you hear in the birth of the Muslim Brotherhood in the 1920s in Egypt. But even when my father was growing up in Cairo in the 1950s and 60s as well, people were just much more at ease in their sexual skin. Mm-hmm. And one of my motives for writing this book is that I used to hear my father tell the stories of my grandmother who grew up in the village in the Delta, and she had these fantastically full frontal proverbs and sayings which were full of, you know, earthy sexuality. My favorite one is in the book. It's, for those of you who speak Arabic, Madame Bayid Antizi Khalas. So long as it is away from my ass, it's okay. Not talking about the village donkey either. So I began to wonder, well, what's happened? Even within a living memory, people were much more at ease in their sexual skin in Egypt. And if you look at what's happening today, it's very close. Part of the reason for today is the rise of Islamic fundamentalism in the late 1970s, which has very much narrowed people's willingness to think openly about possibilities within Islam, about women, women's rights, the body of a woman, and around sex. At the end of the day, if you really want to control people, you take sex, you wrap it up in religion, and it is an extremely powerful tool of any authoritarian system, be it Islamic fundamentalist or indeed a secular dictatorship. And that is what we have seen playing out in Egypt and much of the Arab region over the last few decades.
Sally?
Well, it's quite a sort of long-winded answer, but I'll try and sort of truncate it. The open kind of carnality of Hinduism was first at threat in the sort of 17th century with the sort of rise of a kind of post-Golden Age Islam and the repressions within that. And you found that a lot of the yogini goddess temples of the time that had these wonderful kind of goddess era sort of statues had their breasts removed and their yonis removed. And then later on, the sort of Raj era crackdown, it's the same sort of thing, the kind of colonial impulse that looked at India and saw all of these sort of succulent houris of the East, as one commentator said, and saw the eunuchs and saw the courtly dancers and all of these sort of sexually quite titillating to the sort of colonial eye, and thought, okay, we're going to crack down on this. And they did sort of legally. They, you know, there had been communities of eunuchs that had existed living in houses for thousands of years in these communities, and they were broken by the Raj in this sort of series of moralizing crackdowns. And then more recently, I think that all of these sort of ideas have been appropriated by a sort of conservative mood, a sort of conservative Hindu mood that's sort of taken on a lot of these values. But yes, it was a long-term campaign of breaking the sexual other by the British. That's the main route.
I'm a bit sort of... I agree with what you say, but I have a slight problem with this because also side by side with all this sort of the fun and the pleasure, etc., there's always been a very strong anti-woman kind of stream running alongside this great joyous river. Because if you when you look at Indian Hindu culture before the Muslims came, the institution of the sati was well developed.
Yes, yeah.
Also, in when you hear about Sita, when she's captured and she's taken away, and when she's finally rescued, Ram is full of rage with her because it's not about her suffering, it's not about her pain, it's not about her anxiety. It's all about his shame that his wife is, and to prove her chastity, she has to walk through fire. So you know there is this thing about punishing women and controlling women's sexuality right the way through. And also, Shireen, in Islam, there's a very famous incident of the necklace with Aisha losing her necklace in the desert and going to look for it and being left behind by the by the group who were there and by the Prophet, and then being found by a man and being brought back to Medina, to Makkah. She brought to Medina. She was brought back to Medina, and then her reputation is in tatters after that. That you know she's been away with this man. God knows what she's been up to. She should be punished. He should divorce her right now. So there is, you know, we can say that there was a great, but always the joy has been, you know, the books are addressed to men. They're not addressed to women. The books are written by men. They're about how to enjoy women. They're about and I don't know whether it is how to enjoy generally for the whole society or whether it is for an elite group of people to enjoy prostitutes.
I think both things are the case. I think that yes, of course, we've been, you know, since men discovered the that they had given birth to children and the sort of idea, the fetishizing of fatherhood, the sort of patriarchy has held sway a bit. But I think what we see in these ancient texts is at least a glimpse of an idea that sex could be enjoyed that's really markedly at odds at least with Britain before its own sexual revolution or the West before its own sexual revolution. And I think we sort of see glimmers of an enjoyment and strong heroine figures. You know, not every telling of the sort of great myths is purely patriarchal. You get sort of softer tellings and you get an idea of lovers enjoying themselves often. So it's true, of course. I mean, we've been in sway to patriarchy for most of our existence. So it's not saying, and unfortunately a lot of feminists today in India would like to hope that this sort of old yogini goddess tradition is these wonderful goddesses who ruled. And this is wishful thinking, really. Yeah. It's wishful thinking, but...
Yeah. So if we look in the context of Islam, certainly what's interesting is that Islam is presented today as being very anti-sex, I mean, essentially bottled up. But what's fascinating is that Islam is not anti-sex. In fact, quite the reverse. Islam recognizes that sex is such a powerful force that if you don't channel it and you don't regulate it, it's going to cause a fitna. It's going to cause confusion in society. One of these channels is marriage. The other is concubinage, thankfully a bygone practice, although... I'm very intrigued to hear about the concubines of China. But in any case, what's interesting if one looks back at, for example, the hadith, the accounts of the sayings and doings of the Prophet Muhammad, it's very interesting that he talks about the importance of sexual pleasure within marriage, but he talks about the importance of it for both men and women. And in fact, there's a very famous account of, it's in one of the premier guides to marriage etiquette from the 10th and 11th century, the Prophet said, he talked about, you know, how good lovemaking is essentially really important to be a good Muslim. And and so even in these great books of Arabic erotica, which I grant you are not some sort of medieval Masters and Johnson, they are not telling us exactly what happened inside bedrooms of that period, but they are giving a sense of what might have been considered to be acceptable to happen behind private closed doors. And in these books, it's not just about concubines, it's not just slave women, it's wives. And there are chapters and chapters about how to please women. Mm-hmm. In large part as a route to male satisfaction, of course. Mm-hmm. But it is there, and the importance is there. And certainly what is interesting if one looks today is that the real burden of sexual regulation across the Arab region falls on women. And the idea that women should be able to express their sexual desires, even in private, is really very difficult for many of the women, married women I spoke to in the course of researching this book, because they just thought it was shameful to articulate their desire, which is one of the reasons, and I have a section in my book on this, why lingerie is such a hot seller across the Arab region. But can I ask the question, how many people here have been to Cairo? Okay, fantastic. Please come again. We need your tourist dollars. How many of you have actually seen the lingerie boutiques in downtown Cairo? Oh, well, here, you have to come now, because you're missing out on one of the great attractions. They're full of the frothiest, frilliest, frankly tarty stuff you can ever imagine. And when I went shopping there to prepare my own trousseau, I was amazed, because I saw all these women in hijab and niqab, face veils. What are you doing here, buying this stuff? And as one of the women explained it to me, Shireen, we know in the West that this sort of lingerie is often seen as a tool of male oppression. It turns women into these frilly, frothy sex objects. But you've got to understand, for us, it is a tool of empowerment. It is a shame for me to say to my husband, I want to have sexual relations. But I put on, for example, she showed me her red crotchless lacy underpants. And, you know, what more needs to be done? Yes, it is curious that women are now so tightly controlled, the emphasis on virginity, for example. But I think what's interesting is to really ask the question, why are men so intent on controlling women's sexuality?
Yes, but that's an old thing. They've always wanted to control women's sexuality. Part of it is to do with paternity and inheritance of land and property.
But I would argue as well, there is male insecurity.
Oh,
it plays in.
What's that?
I know. You heard it here first. I can tell you that these great books of erotica, endless chapters on how to improve your performance. And this is a long-standing concern for Arab men. And indeed, in Egypt, I can tell you that after the after the uprisings of 2011, inflation through the roof. The only thing the price of which is not rising in Egypt is Viagra, which is actually cheaper than before the uprising. And indeed, Viagra is a wedding gift in Cairo. And it also operates as an alternative currency, because you can get your paperwork done much faster from the bureaucracy if you can slip a few blue tablets. But again, it all comes from male insecurity, and it's the idea that women, actually in Islam, women's sex drive is seen as so much more powerful than men's, that is why we have to control it. It is hard for men to keep up in all respects, which I think is interesting, because I don't think it also speaks to what you were talking about in terms of sexual violence on the streets as well.
Yeah.
How much of that comes from men's insecurity and
controlling a dangerous female sexual energy or distracting female energy, of course.
Or just feeling or at least in the context of Egypt, for example, where we've had these horrific outbreaks of sexual violence and sexual assault, that men are feeling incredibly pressured in these authoritarian power structures. And when you put men under pressure, they behave badly. And in a patriarchy, the next people down the line they behave badly to are women.
And this is true. I mean, many people say that most of us will know, obviously, of the sort of horrific gang rape in 2012 and a bust in Delhi. Mm. And one of the sort of contributing factors to that, the sort of ruthless groups of males who are perpetrating a lot of these sort of gang rapes, are men who, largely due to sort of female infanticide, can't get wives. The wives simply don't exist because they were killed before birth. So they can't get jobs, and they're seeing their poor success economically and romantically, and they're looking at the sort of successful middle-class Indian women, and they're blaming those middle-class Indian women, and that's where the sort of sexual violence seems to have at least part of its root. It's a punishment tool.
And also with growing inflation and with growing unemployment, and also the Egyptian population is going through the roof, that you have men who can't afford to get married, who can't afford to pay for the wedding, and let alone maintain a family. And I thought one of the loveliest things in your book, Shirin, was that man who was standing in Tahrir Square while all this ferment was going around him, and people are sort of saying, we want to be free of Mubarak, go. And he's holding a placard saying, I want to get married. And I think...
That's a lovely anecdote, yeah.
But I think, you know, generally, I mean, Egypt is a authoritarian state. It has had dictatorships all along. Pakistan is one which has had dictatorships and democracy. India is a country which has had uninterrupted democracy, and yet the violence towards women is the same in all three societies. So I don't think it has so much to do with politics as such. It's more to do with other power structures.
But the patriarchy at the level of politics is reflected in the patriarchy in the family.
Yes.
And what's interesting about the example of India, and it's extremely sobering for those of us sitting in Egypt and elsewhere in the Arab region, is here we are struggling towards, you know, some semblance of democracy sometime in the foreseeable future, we hope. And yet we look to the world's biggest democracy, mm-hmm. the oldest democracy in the yeah. global south, and yet you have, you know, there are all the same problems and
exactly.
then some. Mm. But again, if you don't anchor these, we talk about, you know, justice and freedom and dignity and equality, but if we don't think what that's going to look like in private life and in sexual life, it's not going to make a huge difference mm. to everyday living, even if it exists in the political realm. Mm. You have to connect the two, and this is where there is a gap. And I see it even in Egypt amongst the so-called revolutionaries. I talk in my book, I went down to Tahrir Square, and, you know, talking to these young people who were literally fighting and dying in the streets for their vision of political freedom. And when I asked them, do you think that freedom would translate into sexual freedom, they were frankly horrified. They said, no, this is not what we are looking for. We believe in Islam. We believe in the marriage institution, what I called the citadel in my book, this impregnable fortress. This is not what we are looking for. But until people start to make those connections, and I do talk about some groups in the region which very much connect, see the connection between the political and the personal, but until we achieve that, how much will change in everyday life for women and for men?
Mm. I think the situation in India is different in a sense that you do see in the sort of personal, and you do see there's an annual India Today survey about sort of sex and sexual appetites in India that's been going for about sort of 10, 11 years. And in 2003, I think 20% of young people said that they believed in sex before marriage, and 2 years ago, 50% of people do. 50% of young people do. So there is this real sort of shift, and women saying for the first time ever that they would refuse sex within marriage with their husbands if they were bored or didn't fancy it. And this compares to the law in India, and the sort of legal instituted law says that sort of rape within marriage is non-existent. It doesn't. There's no such thing as rape within marriage. So I think the sort of the legal structure isn't keeping pace with social change there, and that actually sort of the appetite of many Indians for this sexual revolution is there. Mm. It's just that the sort of legal and the sort of political haven't kept up.
Mm. And how much is the sexual revolution informed by changes in technology, with the availability of the internet, with, you know, you can, as you said in your book, you know, kids are watching porn on their phones all the time.
Mm.
How much has this changed people's expectations, people's desires, people's expression of their sexuality?
Well, I think it has sort of good and bad expressions. I think, as I said to you earlier, that of the 10 cities in the world that have the most sort of page impression downloads of porn, 7 of them are in India. So there's a huge consumption of porn. And, you know, westernised porn, this is one reason that many of the sort of young male fantasies include the white Western woman and this sort of idea of the sexualised white Western woman, because they see the sort of gyrating form of exactly
God,
this
end of... I would have liked to have done all the research that she did.
Exactly. You know, I've got a lot of offers from young men who sort of said, do you want me to help you? I live in Delhi, but I'm open-minded. I used to live in Sheffield. So let me know what that means. I think there's access to all of these ideas, of course. You know, even sort of people who live in kind of rural communities have phones that they can download sort of sexual images to.
Mm.
So I think this, and then I think the sort of the less sordid, perhaps, sort of spread of information mm-hmm. about different... And you know...
And HIV.
And then matchmaking, you know. Yeah. Things like Charlie.com has suddenly taken matchmaking out mm-hmm. of the realm of your parents and that mm-hmm. generation before into your own hands. Mm-hmm. So you can say, hey, mm-hmm. I can find this sort of mm-hmm. good boy from my own caste mm-hmm. that you can't because you don't have access to this world. So
I am a Western educated boy of Wheatish complexion.
Exactly, yeah. exactly. Yeah.
Shane?
Well, to begin with, I wouldn't talk about a sexual revolution in the Arab region. We don't even have a political revolution, yeah. quite frankly. I talk about sexual evolution. Mm. Change is coming, but change takes time. Technology is one of the drivers of this. And as you say, isn't anywhere in the world, particularly the internet, is both a boon but also a bane, quite frankly, when it comes to sexual life. So in terms of actual benefits, you mentioned about the teacher. And the rather, you know, fast-track approach to sexual reproductive health education. Well, we don't even have that in most countries in the Arab region.
No, I was in an elite school in Pakistan. You don't the government curriculum doesn't cover it. I was doing a Cambridge Board of Education. So,
well, we, you know, if we could even get to that. So, what usually happens in Egypt, for example, is that. If the teacher is, you know, sufficiently motivated to teach this incredibly flimsy, rather ill-informed lesson, not a curriculum, a lesson, usually sends the girls out of the room. And if I can just tell you a very quick anecdote about that, the upshot of this is that I was, in the course of my research, I was approached by a student in her 20s at one of Egypt's leading universities. She asked me, Dr. Shireen, I have a question. If I'm newly engaged, and if my fiancé stands in front of the air conditioner, will I become pregnant? And it turned out that the only class that this girl had ever received on reproductive biology was plant biology. So she had conflated pollen with sperm and thought I was going to waft off and impregnate her. Yeah, if you were laughing, right? At one level, this is hilarious. At the other level, it is tragic. And you wonder why, for example, divorce rates are shooting through the roof in many Gulf states. It's because people have very unrealistic expectations of what's going to happen in marriage. So the internet actually becomes quite useful in this regard in terms of providing information. And when I actually started writing this book in 2007, 2008, there was very little information available in Arabic. And you can get a million Salafi websites preaching fire and brimstone and, you know, eternal damnation, infection, blindness, you name it, because of masturbation. Okay, no shortage of those. Finding reliable information in Arabic was extremely challenging. There's actually a new website which started 2 months ago, which is very interesting, which is for the first time trying to address these issues. And one of the big challenges is finding an Arabic you can use. Because most Arabs, if they can speak about sex in a language other than Arabic, French, English, or even Hebrew, would rather do that than speak in Arabic. Mm-hmm. And which is so tragic because 1,000 years ago, we used to have whole dictionaries of sex. One of these books talks about there being 1,083 verbs for to have sex. And today we have so little language that women just don't want to talk about it. So reclaiming Arabic as a language of sexuality, very important, these websites do it. The other tremendous benefit is for what we would call in the West, or international speak, LGBTQ, so lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, transsexual, queer populations. A whole set of issues around for them, which we can get into, but certainly, you know, aside from the very practical matter of hooking up, which becomes possible with Gay Romeo or many of these other sites, particularly for women who have same-sex relations who are much more isolated than men. We also have NGOs in most of our countries now, which are producing magazines online, which are providing very sort of reliable, informed, interesting, badly needed information for these groups, these sexual alternative sexualities. But of course, only a minority of people in the Arab region have access to the internet. And most women, when they have access to the internet, don't have it on their own laptop or their iPad. It's with the family computer, and guess who's watching? Mother, father, brothers, uncles. You can't escape the surveillance. On the other side, the downside of the internet is, of course, the pornography. And in my book, I talk about a hairdresser slash... she doubles in magic, basically. That's a whole separate story. But a lot of women would come to her asking for little talismans. I mean, this is within the framework of Islam, talismans to stop their husbands from wandering. And one of the problems that she was encountering is that women would come and their husbands were asking for anal or oral sex. And these women felt very uncomfortable, very unhappy about this. But the problem is that when they tried to spark it up in the bedroom a little bit, their husbands were so horrified. And in one case, I quote, a bridegroom hauled his bride out of bed and made her swear on a Quran that she had had no experience before marriage just because she had gone on the internet and tried to find a few alternative positions. So the internet benefit, but also it just pumps up the pressures within even within marriage.
Talking of gay groups in India, I thought one of the loveliest stories in your book was about the gay prince who set up a retirement home for gay men.
A retirement home for gay men and eunuchs that he called Janet, inexplicably. I never got to the root of it.
But do tell.
Yes, so he's a sort of, and some people may know of him, Manvendra Singh Gohil. He's a very sort of colourful character who is of a sort of former royal family who came out. He'd been sort of forced to marry in his 20s and sort of came out at 27 and turned all of his sort of regal history and then became this sort of strange sort of international star, actually. He was on Oprah several times, and he now has set up a community because he sort of loves the history of these sort of sexual other groups and how they used to live in these kind of almost kind of closed communities. So he set up his own community in the sort of bleached farmlands of Gujarat. And there he kind of gathers people, because obviously in a sort of nation with sort of no social security net, your family is your social security net. So there's 15% of men who do come out and who don't marry and fake their lives.
Where do they go when they
go when they become elderly? If they're lucky enough to become elderly. So often they're just on the streets and begging. So he performs this sort of function and recreates a society that used to exist for sexually other people. And he says one of the great tragedies is the sort of importing of the idea of Western homosexuality and its very narrow definition, actually, of homosexual sex. And historically, the idea of queer in India would take in people who enjoyed anal sex, people who, men who could only produce female children would be queer.
Really?
Yes. So it was quite
a kind of... India was gay.
Yeah. Amongst his other flaws or various tastes, yeah.
He had one boy.
Yeah. It was a very interesting meeting.
I found these people, the individuals in the books who are pushing against the boundaries, very very interesting. there's that sexologist in Chennai, Dr. Reddy, who calls the whole of sex this area. I specialize in this area, which I thought was lovely. But also the helpline, where people get asked questions like, can I wash my pants with, a woman asking if she can wash her pants with a man's pants, or would she get pregnant?
It's the same sort of, as much as you were saying about this sort of ignorance. So you have these characters like this sexologist in Chennai who sort of advertises his service via text message and gets a lot of customers who are just frankly bamboozled by the new world, who have exposure to porn and don't know what to do. And there's a very sort of similar anecdote that he told of... that actually sort of I'd been told by an Irish priest that there's a sort of similar circumstance when he'd get girls coming to him with bruises around their belly button because the sort of young man had thought that he had to sort of insert his penis here. So, but it's a shame because to a certain extent the education shouldn't be so fringe and there shouldn't be these people making so many mistakes and being so confused by it all. But he was also saying that as the sort of commercial enters the sort of domain of marriage in a way, he's got people who are coming to him, and when the boy can't get it up, formally perhaps the woman would be blamed and the marriage would be dissolved and perhaps they'd try and get some money, get the whatever. Now they're taking the boy's family to court for faulty goods. And he's having to testify.
So we have the other side of the equation, in which it is known female virginity remains a huge deal. It's a huge deal in the Arab region. And
I loved the fake high ones made in China.
Yes, so that created quite a political stir in Egypt. But it, what's interesting is how virginity is defined in many Arab societies. And it actually exemplifies a much bigger social problem we have. This is the gap between appearance and reality. It's not what you do that really disturbs people. It's what you're seen to be doing. And virginity exemplifies that. So female virginity in most Arab communities is defined not by a state of chastity, the reality. It is defined by a piece of anatomy, an intact hymen. And there are many ways to demonstrate this. I mean, there are many states to try to preserve this. FGM is done largely to curtail women's sexual drive, it's believed, in order to preserve virginity. Girls can't go out, the famous not riding bicycles in Saudi Arabia, preserving female virginity. We have virginity exams, which are demanded by couples very often, by the family of the groom, or even mandated by the state in some circumstances, in the case of Egypt, to show virginity. We have the practice of dukhla, in which you put a cloth under the bride on the wedding night in order to catch the blood of defloration, all these ways to reinforce this idea. But what is interesting, when I interviewed women about this, and I asked them very often, would you like to have, you as a young married woman, would you like to have the freedom to have relations before marriage that you see in the West? And they said, no, not really. That's not what we think is of the benefit of sexual culture in the West. What we really want is the ability to control our bodies. I'm a believing Muslim. I'm a believing Christian. I think virginity is important. The way that they defined sexual freedom was the freedom to choose for themselves and to make that choice an informed way and not to have interference. And that is their definition of sexual freedom.
To choose a husband or to choose when to have sex?
They're not asking, I want the freedom to have relations before marriage. I want my virginity, my hymen, to be my own business, for example. And what I find very interesting in interviewing people across the region is that they very often knew the score. They knew what sexual life was more or less in the Arab region, more or less outside in the West. But very often they are making different decisions, not out of ignorance, but based on information. And to give you the example of many, many gay activists I met in the Arab region, when I asked them, do you want the freedom to come out? And they would say, no, that's not the freedom we're looking for. We are looking for the freedom to stay in and have relations behind closed doors. So at the end of the day, people are aspiring to sexual freedom, but it's the freedom to make an individual informed choice. And I think the challenge for those in other parts of the world is to respect the fact that that choice may take very different forms than what you see in your own society.
That's true.